This audio program is presented by Audible.com. Audible. Audio that speaks to you wherever you are.
Mogworld by Yahtzee Croshaw. Quick, 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 quick. A dream about my father chasing me through the fields with a pig sticker took an even more nightmarish turn when he started emitting a rhythmic, high-pitched screech. Then I swam dizzily into full wakefulness to find an alarm sprite floating through the dormitory. It had to be an emergency. They didn't deploy alarm sprites lightly. It takes two fairly high-level mages to shut the damn things up. And I'd spent enough time at St. Gordon's Magical College to know that any emergency involving magic is something you want to get away from as fast as you can. After a minute of confused bustle in which dressing gowns were thrown on and several sets of slippers thudded their way downstairs, I and the rest of the second years followed the squealing ball of light into the entrance quad. The ear-molesting noise was immediately joined by the screams of several other alarm sprites, as the rest of the student body filed out into the pre-dawn gloom. That's when I knew that something was really wrong. An alarm in itself wasn't that unusual, especially not in the second-year dorm. After spending the entire first year learning theory and taking the mandatory psychological tests, students tended to be overly enthusiastic with their first firebolts. But a full evacuation of the entire student body, 57, and faculty, 4, wasn't usually necessary. "Jim!" called Mr. Everwind, my tutor. Sweat was dripping from the brim of his pointy hat. "Line up the second years at the back." We were too rattled to do anything but obey, taking up position behind the third years. All of the students had been arranged by year into a rather haphazard rectangle that didn't seem to have anything to do with the usual drill procedure. Suddenly the sun began to rise, spilling orange dawn over the rolling green hills of the surrounding plains. I noticed that the horizon was a lot more textured than I remembered, and more bristling with siege weaponry. An army was advancing towards the school. Just as I had done on my first day, I deeply resented the fact that St. Gordon's Magical College was not, in fact, a castle. "All right, chaps, settle down," said the headmaster, resplendent in his star-patterned cardigan, as he strode back and forth in front of the student body. "Let me assure you all that there is absolutely no reason to panic." The rising tension was not eased in the slightest. "It's probably just some misunderstanding. Stop chewing, Haverson. But a Straganoffian army appears to be attacking the college. Now, don't worry. You are only here as a precaution. We have enlisted a former graduate, Ponyleaf the Enchanter, and his adventuring party to aid us. And I want you to show them the same respect you'd show to me, understand? I said spit that out, boy!" Ponyleaf was tall and thin, with a curly beard and the kind of rugged tan and fidgety nervousness that comes from a career adventuring through the gnoll and goblin-haunted wilderness. He stepped forward, separating himself from a bored-looking Lolidian dwarf and a poorly dressed anorexian warrioress who looked chilly in every sense of the word. "Good morning," he said with a cough, turning his staff over in his hands. A furious ongoing roar was slowly edging into earshot, punctuated by the clash of swords against shields. "Good morning, Mr. Ponyleaf," droned the bewildered student body dutifully. "Now what we're dealing with here is a loose alliance of student fighters from the warrior schools just over the border in Straganoff. Obviously not much of a match for veteran adventurers like us. They're here because the King of Straganoff has put out a quest to recover the Stone of Solomus that was left with this college by its founders hundreds of years ago. Now, obviously, we will never surrender the stone to such bully boy tactics, but I would ask that I and my fellows be allowed to look after the stone for its protection, and so that we can wave it at the enemy for purposes of psychological warfare." "We don't have the stone," said the headmaster, as Ponyleaf met his gaze hopefully.
"You what?"
"We've only been open 6 years. There's no such thing as the Stone of Solomus. The king's mad. Last year he made his son marry a koi pond." An awkward silence passed, or at least it would have been a silence were it not for the increasingly loud war cry and wet thudding of booted feet upon the dewy morning grass, not to mention the subtle clinking of light armour as the two other members of Ponyleaf's adventuring party attempted to shuffle towards the back gate unnoticed.
"Can I be perfectly frank?" said Ponyleaf eventually. "We're kind of only doing this because we were hoping you'd let us have the stone as a reward."
"Well, that's obviously not going to happen."
"No, no, I see that."
He looked behind him and did a double take that was just a little bit too obvious.
"Sorry, it seems my colleagues have wandered off somewhere. I'm just going to see where they went and come right back."
Then he left, quickly. The frontmost rank of armoured frat boys was now over the last hill and had broken into a run. The ground was quivering in almost perfect synchronization with my stomach. "Right then," said the headmaster, tight-lipped, eyes fixed on the fence over which Ponyleaf had just vaulted. "I know most of you didn't really expect to be practising this level of combat magic this early in your career, but I think I can say that if I were an invading army, I'd certainly be given pause for concern by such a formidable rank of enchanters as— God damn it, Haverson, I told you once before about—" The vibrating rear half of an arrow suddenly appeared in his temple. He concluded his sentence with a few spit bubbles before falling over. A large chunk of our defence force took this as the invitation to run away. But I didn't. Furious tears were forming in my eyes. I'd spent my last vegetable tray on tuition fees. Home was at least 5 turnips worth of journey away, and more to the point, the last place I wanted to go. St. Gordon's might not have been the most prestigious magic college in the world, and its graduates generally couldn't entertain any ambitions beyond running a pest control business, but it was all I had. The creaky wooden gates were pulverized into splinters under a whirling cloud of iron boots and training warhammers. I extended a hand and began to incant. Arcanus, Inferus, I don't actually remember if I was able to get a firebolt off. I have a vague memory of seeing orange light splatter harmlessly against a spiked breastplate, but that might just have been sparks from all the metal rubbing against metal. Then there was a sound rather like a bag of wet laundry being hurled across a gravel driveway, and that was the first time I died. Everything seems a whole lot more peaceful when you're dead, even watching your own pelvis being kicked around the quad by guffawing adolescent berserkers has something transcendental about it, when you're looking down on it from about 6 feet up and ascending. Maybe it was the way everything was tinted a strange bluish grey, and seemed to be glowing with an eldritch light. As I continued to drift upwards, the world began to fade. The majestic sight of the warrior hordes breaking all of St. Gordon's front windows blurred, and not just from distance. At the point of death, all sound had suddenly crashed into silence, as if I'd thrust my head into ice-cold water. But now the quiet was somehow deepening. What I had previously accepted to be complete silence was a cacophony compared to what I wasn't hearing now. The land of the living was still there, barely. It had been reduced to a collection of dim shadows that were almost invisible against the cosmic brilliance of the beyond. What I remember most vividly of all is the light, bright as anything, and my ghostly eyes were open wide. But it didn't dazzle me. It wasn't just a light at the end of a tunnel, unless the tunnel was also made of light. It was everywhere, all around me. And I was part of it. I was watching the light, and at the same time, I was the light watching me. I think I was still ascending, but it was becoming harder and harder to tell. The world was turning below me, reduced to little more than a faint smear against the light. I saw the college, the surrounding county, and the lands of Stragonoff toiling under the heel of demented monarchs. I saw the kingdom of Borregaard, where I had been born, along with all its neighbouring territories, their ancient borders and writhing battlegrounds now made meaningless. I saw the entire continent of Garethi, 1,000 rural hues of brownish green and greenish brown, spreading from ocean to ocean like rotting seaweed on a calm beach. I saw the entire planet, from the jungles of Anorexia to the urban sprawl of Lolaid City. I saw the glittering sphere hanging in the blackest darkness, and somewhere at the back of my mind I realized that Flat World Frobisher owed me 20 quid. I could see it all, but I was still ascending. The world of my birth shrank from a planet to a moon to a beach ball to a pea to a grain of sand to gone. Now there was nothing but the light, and a new sound was drifting through the stillness. A beautiful voice was calling me, singing songs of beckoning, and as the delicate tones passed my ears I felt a giddy and instinctive state of rapturous love. For just a few more songs I would have done anything for that voice. I would have... well, I wouldn't have died for it, obviously. I was ahead of the game there. The light took form around me, breaking off bits of itself like clay, and reshaping them into, what else could they have been, angels. Their blank, featureless faces were strangely beautiful, shining with a golden inner light. They took my spectral arms, holding them ever so gently, and aided my ascent. Their every touch, every movement, every sound they breathed into my ears, all communicated the same thing, love. Undying and all-powerful. I had passed on from life, from the world of struggles and hardship and big fat women with annoying laughs, and entered a glorious new existence of utter peace and joy and love. And then some git brought me back to life. It began as a soft pulling sensation and grew violently in strength. The light went away, fast. The world was speeding back towards me, a gigantic custard pie hurled by a universe determined to make me the butt of some cruel, cruel joke. I scrabbled for purchase with my astral fingers, desperately clawing for something to cling to, anything that would mean I wouldn't have to go back down there. But no. The universe refused to see things my way, and my spirit returned to my body like a punch in the gut. I sat bolt upright, or at least tried to. My forehead discovered something hard and wooden overhead, and my skull fell back down with an audible crack. A handful of dust in my lungs interrupted my attempts to swear, and I spent a few instructive moments in a wretched coughing fit, clutching at my head. I noticed that most of my hair was missing, and as my hands travelled down, that my face was thin and sunken. Okay, I thought. I'm not going to panic. I'm going to take a deep breath. Okay, I'm not going to take a deep breath, but I'm going to count to 10 and take stock, and I'm going to stay calm. I died, I recalled, mouthing the words airlessly. Oh, well, could happen to anyone, everyone even, and now I've come back to life, so I can't exactly complain, can I? I'm in a coffin. That's where they put dead people. It makes sense. Ho-hum. There's no air in here. La-di-da. Who needs air? Not me, anymore, apparently. My body seems to have been wasting away for many years. Well, I never. A loud rumbling from deep within the bowels of the earth shut me up. The ground shook violently. I could feel the spiders in my lungs clinging to alveoli for dear life. And there's an earthquake going on. Fiddle dear, let me out, let me out! The nails were old and gave way almost instantly, but then there was something heavy on top of the coffin pinning down the lid. I strained until both wood and limb were creaking like talkative garden gates, until finally I felt weight shifting, my lid flew off, and I was catapulted bolt upright. Light drilled uncomfortably into my long unused retinas. Normal, boring torchlight, not the glorious holy light of recent memory. I knuckled away a succession of fat pink afterimages, and coughed up something that looked very much like a cobweb. I was in a crypt. That made sense. I was dead, after all. The walls were lined with alcoves containing battered coffins not unlike my own, mostly smashed open. The torches on the walls were freshly lit, and the thick piles of dust on the floor were disturbed by very recent track marks. There came a clattering to my immediate right. I glanced over just in time to see the coffin that had been on top of mine burst open and a skeleton tumble out. It went. Then it fell apart. I was attempting to crawl along the ground away from it when another quake shook the crypt. A large portion of plaster and stone disassociated itself from the rest of the ceiling by an inch or two, and reddish dust rained down. "What the hell is going on?" was what I tried to say, but my lungs were still dusty, and it came out more like "Woo-hoo-cock." It did the trick, though. A greyish head peered around the corner of a nearby tunnel. It was a corpse, his complexion pale and scarred, one glassy eye dangling down a waxy cheek. His body had clearly been dead for quite a long time, but the message apparently hadn't reached his brain.
"Oh, hello,"
he said, his voice reverberating as if his throat was full of gravel.
"Do you have any idea what's going on?"
"No."
I had coughed out the last of the dust, but my voice was just as rough and raspy as his.
"No, I do not know what's going on. I was dead. I kind of expected things to stop going on."
"It's just a bunch of us just woke up in here and no one seems to know why."
He offered a hand and helped pull me to my feet.
"You got off pretty lightly."
"Got off lightly?"
"All four limbs, both eyes. Shame about your nose, but you should see the state of some of the others."
I was fingering a rather ghastly triangular hole in the middle of my face when the room shook once again, in the way a human would say, "Ahem," with a noise like the enthusiastic mating of giant stone golems. The far wall buckled inwards and part of the floor gave way. The skeleton, still trying to stand up, fell from sight with a terrified followed by the remains of my coffin and presumably my nose.
"We'd best get out of here," said my new friend.
I nodded, took a step, and fell flat on my face. It would have probably been quite traumatic for a person with a nose, but fortunately I was ahead of the game there.
"Sorry,"
he said, helping me up again.
"You're a bit wobbly. Expecting to wake up fresh and ready to go after being dead for a while would be a bit optimistic."
"Well, yes, expecting to wake up at all would have been a bit optimistic."
"Hey, don't take it out on me. I'm trying to help."
Specifically, he was trying to help me run away from whatever was causing all the rumbling and from the increasingly collapsing floor. Old and long unused signals from my brain were having trouble making the long climb down my spinal column to my limbs. I stumbled through the underground chambers on my colleague's shoulder, sensation returning to my feet and joints by tiny increments. The thought was sinking in with greater and greater certainty and considerably greater discomfort. I was dead. I was alive and dead at the same time. I was undead. My current biological status was aggravatingly inconsistent. I had seen zombies before. There had been a necromancer's tower in the village near my family farm, and you'd sometimes see an undead slave lurching through the marketplace. On shopping days, me and a few other kids used to flick bits of bread at them so that hungry seagulls would chase them around. And then later, at college, Mr. Everwind was in the habit of raising undead teaching assistants, and a popular hazing ritual was to steal the undead command stone from the staff room and use it to make them pole dance on the school flagpole. I remembered how amusing it had been at the time to watch them move around as if their joints were held together with elastic bands. Now I just wanted to know how they had made it look so easy. Getting to grips with myself would have to wait, because now the floor was rumbling continuously. We staggered through another archway moments before it cracked, and into a wide nexus of passageways at the bottom of a steep flight of stairs. Moonlight shone invitingly down towards us, but in our current state, the steps might as well have been the north face of Mount Murdercruel. Several of my fellow undeads were milling around waiting for someone to take charge.
"Found another one," said my helper, jiggling me.
"Oh," said a balding woman with no arms, "look at this fancy Dan with his four functioning limbs."
"And his skin hardly flaking off," said a man with no face on his skull.
Said someone else with no lower jaw.
"I bet he could still maintain an erection," grumbled a decrepit old corpse who probably had issues.
Between us, there were about six complete bodies, spread out over around 10 individuals. There was more exposed bone and sinew on view than in a dumpster behind an abattoir, and everyone was wearing expensive funeral attire that had become faded and torn by the passage of time. The whole effect was rather like the aftermath of an explosion at a high-class dinner party. For the first time, I took a moment to examine myself properly. I was wearing what had probably once been a basic mage's robe, creamy brown linen stitched into a pattern that the nearest convenient tailor to the funeral home had probably thought was mystic and artsy. Time, however, had not been kind to it. Both elbows were worn right through. Threads all over the garment had come unstitched, and now dangled shamefacedly from all over my body. The tailoring had been utterly spoiled by whatever thoughtless person had cut a huge slit in the back from neck to arse. A particularly loud clash of falling ceiling echoed through the subterranean halls, and the floor was starting to shake again. I and the assembled undead collectively realized that we were still far from safety. A section of nearby wall slid into the abyss that was all that remained of my tomb, and a huge cloud of dust billowed out. Now half blind and fighting off a powerful desire to lie down and go back to sleep, I tottered over to the stairs, fell forward, and began wildly flinging my elbows and knees upwards in an impromptu attempt at climbing.
"Look, he can even climb stairs,"
said the man with no face, struggling to follow.
"God, life's wasted on the young, isn't it?" said the woman with no arms.
The fellow with no lower jaw was probably planning to add something, but then the ground cracked open beneath his feet and he was swallowed by the earth with a tongue-flapping wail of fright. It's amazing how imminent peril can aid recovery from rigor mortis. I was making decent speed, and was already halfway to fresh air. At this rate, I'd be perfectly fine as long as I was never called upon to do anything complicated like shake someone's hand or sit in a chair. The rumbling was turning into a roar. The stairs were starting to shift beneath my hands and feet, and small bits of rock were raining down upon us constantly. A much larger bit of rock decided to join in the fun, and thundered down the steps, but it flew over me and collided with someone I hadn't had time to care about. Being the most functional horrors present, I and the chap who'd found me were the first to reach the top. My arms and legs continued spinning through thin air for a few moments before I collapsed onto dead grass. A handful of the others were able to escape before the crypt entrance uttered a final impatient cough and caved in.
"Wait a second, I know this place,"
said the man with no face, who had been the third to emerge.
"This is the graveyard near Whitbury Farmstead, in Goodsoil County."
I knew of Goodsoil County, but I had never been there in life, because of the rumours that circulated about the native farmers and what they got up to with domestic animals and unsuspecting travellers. It had not, as far as I could remember, been fingered as a dark and sinister place that oozed an atmosphere of tangible evil from every square foot of ground. But that was the sort of thing that could easily be overlooked if you were concentrating on keeping your private places away from backward rural folk. The crypt had been the centrepiece of a vast graveyard that rolled away in all directions, a stark navy of grey stone slabs sailing upon an ocean of dead grass. It was hilly country, surrounded by a black pine forest from which emanated the growl of predators and the abruptly cut-off squeals of their prey. Once again the ground began rumbling underneath me. Oh, for crying out loud, I thought, was a single moment to myself too much to ask? I jumped back just as the dying grass split asunder and a zombie hand burst forth, flesh hanging from it like puff pastry from an aging apple turnover. It clawed the air for a moment, and an involuntary yelp of terror escaped from my lips. After that, though, it seemed to be having trouble, so my new colleagues and I helped pull it out, closely followed by the owner.
"Thanks," he said, reattaching his arm. "Why am I alive?"
The same question was occurring to the graveyard's entire population, who were popping up like extremely fast-growing, foul-smelling daisies. That was what had caused the cave-ins, I realized. The graves were so packed together that the simultaneous stirring of their residents had caused massive trauma to the local geology. Of course, the huge green crystals probably weren't helping either. They were sitting on makeshift towers made from metal girders, thin and flimsy-looking, but tall enough to loom over the treetops, and which were erected at regular intervals around the graveyard's perimeter. Mounted on the top of each tower was an irregular lump of green crystal, probably magical stone, judging by the way it glowed, and the arcs of chartreuse lightning crackling around. As we watched, some unspoken signal caused the crystals to become connected for a brief second by a huge circle of green magical energy, which detached and drifted off into the sky like a smoke ring. "This is necromantic magic," I thought aloud. "Well, duh," said someone. "I mean, it has to be, but I've never seen anything like it. I didn't think it was done with crystals. I thought it was all blood sacrifice and that kind of thing." I tapped my chin thoughtfully, felt exposed bone in my fingertips, and resumed taking stock of my current condition. My hands were skin and bone, in some places just bone, and my flesh was discoloured to a sickly greyish green. None of my fingernails were less than an inch long. My toenails were poking out the front of my flimsy cloth boots. Miserably, I unbuttoned the front of the robe and ran a clawed hand across my chest and belly. A deep scar ran diagonally across my torso, held together with rusty metal staples. At least my nerves had warmed up to the point that now I merely felt as if all four of my limbs had fallen asleep at the same time.
"Do you want to take a look around?"
asked the zombie who'd found me. Now that the earthquakes had stopped, everyone in the graveyard was milling around uncertainly. "No," I said, folding my arms with a series of unpleasant cracking noises. "I'm not moving until someone or something comes along and explains what the hell's going on, and only if it's a good explanation with lots of apologies." Suddenly, there was a thunderclap of magical energies colliding, and a vertical sheet of flame burst forth along the ground several feet away, walling off access. More firewalls started igniting,
forming a zigzag that seemed to be bearing down on us. "That'll have to do," I thought. Somehow I'd leapt to my feet, and I found myself forced to run again. More flaming barriers were bursting up all over the cemetery, and the undead masses were soon high-speed shuffling away from them and towards the graveyard entrance, where a crowd was frantically shoving against a pair of massive iron gates. A few attempted to scatter in different directions and were turned away by pointed bursts of flame. The word shepherding came to mind. "What's going on?" I said, repeating myself somewhat.
"It is a sign for the righteous," said someone next to me, who was gazing at a point above and to the left of him. "We have been resurrected for the Day of Judgment." Too late I noticed his suspiciously cassock-like robe and collar. Mages, even student ones, don't get along with priests. Priests are all about using magic to heal wounds, and mages are all about using magic to create the wounds in the first place. Still, religion was probably the best place to start looking for an explanation, since there was a definite apocalyptic taste to current events. Day of Judgment? He looked down at me in that way priests do, with what remained of his lips smashed tightly together and his eyes staring like I'd just whittled on his daughter.
"The Lord has returned the righteous to life in time for the rapture."
I looked around for my cryptmates, but they had been absorbed by the crowd, and once they reach a certain stage of decomposition, all corpses start to look alike. I said, glancing toward the spooky and unhelpful forest. "Does Almighty God say anything about the itinerary for Judgment Day? I mean, are we supposed to meet him somewhere?" Almost all the resurrected were now gathered around the entrance gates. A couple of forward-thinking undead were rattling the padlock with numb fingers, but they jumped back in terror when a colossal explosion rang out. As one, the crystals disintegrated, filling the air with tiny shards of twinkling green glass. A fork of lightning split the night sky, a boom like the crashing of worlds. The wind picked up, fluttering our rotting rags insanely about our bodies. Something was obviously trying to get our attention.
"This is it," said the priest. "I am returning to my father."
He kicked me in the leg.
"Stand not so close to me, demon, and stain not my soul!"
"Ow!" A laugh screamed out over the graveyard, a hearty and insane laugh, about as far removed from polite after-dinner laughter as you can get. This was the kind of insane laughter even the truly insane have to practice for years to get right. There, standing on top of the gate with legs wide, one fist pointed skyways and one clinging to a nearby pillar for stability, was a cackling silhouette. A bolt of lightning set alight a circle of fuel, obviously prepared beforehand, and a fire quickly rose around his perch.
"Rise, my hordes of darkness!" he shrieked. Then he did that laugh thing again.
With the firelight I could now make out his features. He was very tall and very thin, with the body and skin tone of one who has placed far too many pieces of his soul in far too many evil magic artifacts. He had tried to disguise his skinny build with a thickly padded black cloak, and a pair of spiked shoulder pads the size of watermelons. Framing his sunken face was an ornate obsidian helmet, carved somewhat predictably into the shape of an angry fanged skull. In addition to all that, he was addressing a bunch of dead guys, so he might as well have been wearing a sash with necromancer writ big.
"Rise!" he repeated, throwing up his hands. "Rise and join the ranks of my unholy horde!"
He seemed to notice for the first time that we weren't exactly rushing to his side, but were mainly watching him in the way a zoo patron would watch a crazy monkey, curious but ready to move at the first sign of poo flinging. There was a minute of awkward silence before someone near the back, with their head held under their arm, said,
Who's this twat? Are you God? Asked someone else. The necromancer clearly wasn't prepared for either of those questions, but to his credit he recovered quickly.
Perhaps I am, he said, flashing a winning smile. Your ruler, certainly, and soon the ruler of the world.
He stretched out the word world until a roll of thunder served up the exclamation mark.
March, my undead minions! We ride to my fortress of darkness!
Glances were exchanged between the undead minions in question, most of them directed towards the agnostic speaker of the previous question, who was apparently being groomed as company spokesman. He was a turquoise fellow with missing ears and piles of grave dirt on his shoulders. Do we have to? This time the necromancer's improvisational skills abandoned him. His arms dropped to his sides, and when he replied, the booming insane qualities were missing from his voice.
Well, yes, I mean, you're my undead minions. I raised you from the grave. You have to do everything I say.
Doubt was clearly nagging at him. He extended his hands again, holding his gnarled ebony staff horizontally.
I command thee to march!
Your commands are the futile bleating of the damned bedfellow of the serpent, growled the priest.
March!
A spark of panic materialized in the necromancer's eyes, as if it had finally dawned on him that he had just placed himself right in the middle of a cranky, unstoppable army of unwilling zombies, and identified himself as the source of their misfortune.
March! Walk! Jump up and down! Do a little dance.
The staff wobbled nervously in his grip.
You've got free will, haven't you?
Sort of, said the spokesman.
They've got free will,
called the necromancer to a trio of men in full suits of spiky black armour who had been tending to a quartet of horses some distance away.
How the hell have they got free will?
I don't know what to tell you, Lord Dreadgrave, said one of the soldiers,
his voice echoing nicely in his senselessly huge helmet.
It's your ritual.
Dreadgrave smacked himself in the face with a full open palm.
It's my ritual. It's me, 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 me.
I came in here for a horde. What the hell am I supposed to do with a bunch of smelly independents?
Why don't you just ask us to join your horde? Said the haughty lady with no arms, like polite, decent people do.
Would you really? If I asked, Gartharas, would you put this fire out, please? I think it's coming straight for my shoes.
Maybe, said our spokesman, as the armoured men began stamping on the dwindling ring of flame. I mean, we've never really been in any undead hordes before, so we might be interested in the opportunity to try new things.
And it's not like we've got much else to do with our time now that we're piles of rotting meat and bones that no one besides the utterly depraved would ever want to sleep with,
said the decrepit old corpse, whom I still felt had issues. Dreadgrave tapped his staff against his palm pensively.
Do you want to join my horde?
The undead closest to the spokesman, and the ones who had appointed themselves senior members of the undead community, went into a huddled conference. For a few minutes, all eyes were on a muttering scrumdown of assorted abominations. Someone put forward a motion, someone else seconded it, and the meeting was adjourned.
"What does it pay?" asked the spokesman, after a cough.
"Pay?" said Dreadgrave distastefully. Why should it pay anything?
A collective moan descended on the crowd, and some of them started drifting away, losing interest in the whole stupid affair.
But wait, 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 don't go, don't go, don't go,
said the necromancer, flapping his arms to avoid losing his audience.
What I meant was, why do you want to get paid? What could you possibly want the money for?
No Arms opened her mouth to reply, but no answer was forthcoming. Dredgrave continued,
"You don't need food, you don't need water, you don't need to sleep, so you don't need shelter, so you don't need rent money. You can't get tired, so you don't need to pay for carriages and things. What else is there?"
"Prostitutes," tried Gartharas, leaning amicably on a tombstone.
"Well, like he said, they'd need to be blind or open-minded to a completely shameful degree. I just don't think any of you could have any possible need for a regular wage."
"Just because we don't need it doesn't mean we couldn't find a use for it," said our spokesman. "We could donate it to charity, arrange trust funds for our surviving loved ones, take up antique collecting, go to the opera."
"They wouldn't let you in at the opera."
"Well, that was just an example, wasn't it? We could go to a pantomime or some low-budget musical production or something. The point is, you can't expect to hire an army without incentive. If everyone could do that, the whole economy would collapse." People were starting to drift off again, as they do when words like economy enter the conversation. So Dredgrave was spurred to interrupt.
"Okay, listen, listen. What would you say to a profit-sharing scheme?"
The drifting stopped. The crowd cocked a collective ear.
"Join my horde, and every time we fall upon a town or village, you get to keep everything you loot, minus a small percentage. No, wait, come back, no deductions. No deductions. Maybe a small deduction. Okay, none at all. All yours. And free room and board at my doom fortress."
There was a lot of conferring going on among the shambling dead. I waited to see their decision. I'd been in enough angry mobs in my time to know that the smart money was always with the majority.
"And every month I'll take you all to see a low-budget musical production."
A lot of heads were nodding approvingly now. The spokesman counted a show of hands, then relayed the result. "Done."
"Then march, my undead horde!" screamed Dredgrave, holding his arms aloft and getting back into the swing of things. "We ride to my fortress of darkness!"
Dredgrave's request that we march to his doom fortress could only be obeyed creatively at best, since every zombie had to master his own interpretation of walking. We were learning fast, though. I and the other guys, fortunate enough to have both legs, had almost totally shaken off rigor mortis by the end of the first night, and even the guys with no limbs at all had worked up a decent pace, using only their teeth or their buttocks. In the spirit of marching, Dredgrave's horde lurched, goose-stepped, crawled, shuffled, and chewed its way through Goodsoil County. That was what the guy earlier had called the place, and what was written on the older road signs, but the countryside had seen a lot of changes while we'd all been out of touch. The newer sign seemed to believe they were in a place called Grey Doom Valley, which seemed a lot more appropriate. The day was overcast and grim, while the night was just plain cold and dark. It was like a black cloud had descended to ground level and refused to move on, squatting in place like a big fat toad. The peasants we passed on our way to the Doom Fortress didn't seem to think there was anything good about the soil either. They came out of their tiny hovels to line the roads and gaze at us from under their heavy brows with slack-jawed wonder. They had the skinny builds and pale skin that come from a diet with too much reliance on potatoes and cabbages. All in all, standard local colour with low to middling potential for pitchfork and flaming torch-wielding mob forming. I did have a pleasant conversation with one of the shrewder ones, who was going down the ranks trying to sell sticky buns.
It was from him that I learned that my homeland of Beauregard had been invaded and conquered by the neighbouring kingdom of Pillock 40 years ago. I wasn't that bothered. I had never been patriotic. Whenever the king's carriage had rattled through my home village during his monthly parades through the land, I had usually joined the other kids to run behind him throwing old peaches. But it did mean that I could estimate how long I had been dead. At the time of my sudden and tragic death, I was fairly certain that the fragile peace between Beauregard and Pillock was about due for another collapse. There was a lot of very old, very stagnant bad blood between the royal families. Apparently, in their youth, the two kings had been roommates at Rolled Goat University, and there were several outstanding issues regarding eating each other's food and bringing girls around late at night. Anyway, at the time I had died, I had given it 10 years at most before another big war. Therefore, I must have been dead for roughly 50 years before Dreadgrave came along and proved my eternal slumber to be nothing of the sort. After 4 days' march, we came to the top of one last hill, and Dreadgrave's distinctive voice echoed throughout the plains. "Behold!" he yelled. We laboriously climbed the rise and beheld. We were looking down into a wide valley, and while I had thought the rest of the surrounding country was gloomy, this place made it seem like happy, smiling Bunny Rabbit Junction. Except for the oily foliage around a small decorative swamp the colour of ancient lettuce, there wasn't a scrap of vegetation. The very earth of the valley slopes was grey and cracked, all life drained. A snaking river of unhealthy greenish-brown water bisected the landscape, and a gigantic black cloud hung in the sky, spiralling and swirling madly above the only man-made building in the valley, which squatted over the river like an incontinent titan. Dreadgrave's Doom Fortress looked exactly like Doom Fortresses are supposed to look, a big gnashing skull from the front and a great sprawling insect from above. Veins of obsidian ran across shiny black marble, black pipes and black chimneys placed randomly around the black roof and walls, emitted occasional bursts of decorative black flame. The tallest tower, black, which I took an immediate interest in, was a magnificent 100-foot affair studded with black stone gargoyles of the kind of terrifying hideousness that has to be specially imported from countries with higher suicide rates. "Ooh," went the undead horde. "Pretty snazzy," I said aloud to no one in particular, as we began to march very carefully down the twisting path into the valley's heart. "It is an abomination," said the person walking alongside me. "It is an affront before the House of the Lord." I glanced at him and recognised the all-too-familiar collar. I sighed. "No one's forcing you to tag along, you know."
"Be silent, venomous spittle of the Doom Serpent!" he barked, dodging the issue. "You are a servant of evil, an affront to God's will, a corpse reanimated of devilry that man should not wot of!"
"What?
Indeed!"
"Hey, you're just as much affront to God's will as I am. We've all got the same kind of black magic up our arses."
"You are wrong. I was returned to life by the blessing of the Lord, for he would have me continue my good work of spreading his name."
He stared down at me with both nostrils.
"You are a demon taking human form, a silver-tongued tempter to draw the righteous from the Lord."
"Look, I've got nothing against the Lord," I protested. "I just didn't see him rushing to intervene when that jerk up ahead started bringing us back to life."
"You were not worthy of his gift," he barked,
a hint of mania dropping into his voice. He grabbed my face in one hand and almost knocked me off my feet.
"Out, demon! Leave be the body of this poor wretched soul!"
I shook him off. He was obviously taking an extended holiday from reality, an option that I had to admit I was finding more and more tempting. We had reached the outer wall of the fortress, and the portcullis that filled the entrance slid upwards like retractable fangs into the gigantic skull-shaped archway. The horde shuffled into the main courtyard, where two little desks were set up. Behind each was one of Dreadgrave's armoured human minions, glumly sitting beside stacks of enrolment forms. A third minion, an undead girl who couldn't have been older than 20 when she had died, stood in the middle, earnestly hugging a clipboard to her chest. Dreadgrave nodded to her briefly, then disappeared into the shadows. "Okay!" exclaimed the girl, her voice loud and high-pitched enough to make the maggots in my eardrums wriggle crankily. "Welcome to Grey Doom Valley, and your wonderful new career as one of Lord Dreadgrave's undead minions! My name is Merrill, and I am the company's settlement officer, so if you ever have any problems, or if you just want to chat, my door is always open." Quite a lot of the assembled dead were exchanging confused glances. "Now then, most of you will be working as security or maintenance personnel, but we do have some openings in middle and upper management, which we will assign once we've gotten all your names down and worked out your individual qualifications. But don't worry, there's a place at Grey Doom Valley for even the least qualified, least physically intact zombie." A nearby torso gurgled appreciatively from its neck stump. "We've got quite a lot of people to process," she continued, "so if you could form two orderly queues in front of the desks, we'll have magic users on the left, that's all you mages, priests, conjurers, anyone in the magic industry on the left, and everyone else on the right. If you're not sure where you fit, just go on the right there." The horde began dividing into two grumbling columns. I couldn't help noticing that the priest had joined the queue directly in front of me. I tapped him on the shoulder. "Feel free to leave at any time," I whispered, "this being a den of Satan's progeny and everything."
"I will not leave."
"And why is that?"
"I see now that this is the holy mission with which the Lord has blessed me," he said through his teeth. "I am to destroy this den of evil from within."
"Well, at least give us time to settle down," I said gloomily, losing interest in the conversation. He glared at me for an instant, his lips stretching as far away from his teeth as he could manage. Then he fixed his gaze upon a point somewhere inside his own head and started speaking in dry, croaky tongues. Further interaction was impossible, so I took the opportunity to steal his place in line, and soon enough it was my turn to be interviewed. I stepped forward.
"Name?"
said the hairy man behind the desk, who was wearing a very authoritative spiked helmet. "Jim," I began, but then my rotten memory banks failed. "Jim something."
"James Smith," wrote the officer aloud. "Occupation in life?"
"Magic student."
"Ah, college boy. Were you thinking of a job as a mercenary or just some support role?"
"Support, I suppose." He nodded.
"Good. Seems like everyone else in that cemetery was a mercenary. We're up to our eyeballs in the buggers. Must have been a lot of wars around there, I guess. What we really need is a cook. All the human guards have been eating tinned beans for months. You know anything about cooking?"
"I used to tend bar part-time," I tried. He crossed something out on my form, and I felt a little disheartened.
"Any idea how advanced a magic student?"
"Not very. Firebolts, that's about it."
"Well, there's nothing quite like on-the-job experience for a young corpse's education. You're on the security team. That basically means you hang around the fortress and kill adventurers."
"Just adventurers?" He didn't look up as he wrote.
"Anything that doesn't work here, but it's mostly adventurers, yeah."
I glanced around at the crowded courtyard. Do you really need this many zombies just for adventurers? This time he did look up. His helmet made it hard to tell, but I think he was giving me a very funny look. "Call it erring on the side of caution," he said, with loud sarcasm. "Anyway, it's easy work. I'm sure you'll pick it up quickly. Now I just have to ask a few personal questions for our equal opportunity policy. Country of origin?" "Beauregard," I said. "New Pillock," he wrote.
"Ooh, you're Beauregardian too?" said Merrill, the company settlement officer, who was floating around in an uncertain, supervisory sort of way. "I'm Beauregardian. Did you die in the Pillock Wars?"
No. Before then, I think. College rivalry thing. She was suddenly very interested.
"A pre-integration Beauregardian? Both your parents, too?"
"Yeah, 10th generation, I said guardedly, wondering what she was getting at. My family didn't get around much. Her eyes were shining, or rather, while they were still glowing with the sickly yellow light of necromantic magic like everyone else's, she was now gazing at me like a starving man gazes at a grilled cheese sandwich. She laid a hand on the officer's shoulder and glanced at my application.
"Security! Great! Put him on my detail. I really look forward to working with you, Mr. Smith."
She scampered off about her business, leaving me and the officer baffled. "What was that all about?" he asked, like I would know. "Cough," went the incredibly long queue behind me. "Oh, right, let's keep this moving." He pointed to a nearby archway leading into the fortress. "You're in the main tower. That's the third turning on the right. Keep heading upstairs till you find a free bunk. Welcome aboard. Look forward to working with you, etc. Next!" In the tower, the atmosphere was convivial. As I ascended the perimeter staircase, I paused on each floor to take in the sights. Undead minions sat around on the straw mattresses and sackcloth sheets they would never actually sleep on, chatting, laughing, joking, all prejudices in life forgotten. Idly, I kept an eye out for any of my crypt mates, but one case of decomposition looks pretty much like another after a while. I paused at the staircase to watch some corpses dance country-style to the earnest fiddling of a minion in the corner, seeing their wide smiles, rather unsettlingly wide in the case of the faceless ones. I very nearly considered staying. But no, I thought, shaking my head. This was not the life for me, death for me, unlife, whatever it was. It wasn't for me. I continued up. It really was a very tall tower, and the sun had set by the time I reached the very top, and I emerged from the stairwell to the biting cold breeze of a grey doom evening. I reflected that neither the sensation of cold nor the enormous climb had caused any degree of discomfort in my new undead form, and my magic-powered glowy eye vision let me see to the very edge of the horizon. None of it was any comfort. Somewhere along the last 50 years I'd acquired a new perspective. Maybe it had been my horrific death, or vision of the afterlife, or seeing all the countries of the world unfolding below me. But having witnessed it from the outside, I realized just how futile my life had been. And now I had been living a second one for about 4 days in a far less functional body, and didn't feel there had been any improvement in the key problem areas. So I decided I was done with it. My life had failed its field test. I would leave it for some other sucker. I stepped onto the parapet and glanced sadly down the full height of the tower. Far below me, the last few minions were still queuing politely in the main courtyard, like tiny, mutilated, foul-smelling ants. I snorted. It was easy to feel superior looking down from this height. Perhaps this was why necromancers were always trying to take over the world. There was a full moon, and even the drab landscape of Grey Doom Valley seemed beautiful as it rolled away into the horizon. the very beginnings of dawn were bringing a spectacular tint to the sky. I drank it all in for a few seconds, then jumped off before I could change my mind. The second